Hey, you are listening to The Workplace Leader. This is the podcast where we go behind the scenes of corporate real estate, talking to industry experts about how they shape the next generation workplace. I'm your host, Sabine M., and in today's episode, I'm speaking with Ryan Anderson. Ryan is VP Global Insights and Research at MillerKnoll. Hi, everyone. Another podcast recording in a kind of lonely day in the office because it's kind of an unofficial holiday in Switzerland and a lot of people have taken off. But I have the pleasure to talk to Ryan Anderson. We got introduced by a common connection, actually, and I'm super, super happy he took the time to be on and tell us a bit about what he's doing and what he's seeing in the market, because he is working in the research and insights function within MillerKnoll. But Ryan can tell that much better than I can. So hi, Ryan.
How you doing, Sabine? Thanks for having me.
I'm good. Thank you. Hope you're doing fine as well.
I'm doing well. It's not as lonely on my end. I happen to be in the office today. There's lots of buzz around here. So glad to connect with you.
And I'll be curious to hear later what the MillerKnoll office looks like. I mean, I see a little fraction of it, but I could imagine it would be super, super exciting. But let's start with a little bit of housekeeping. Tell us more about your role and your professional background and how you came to be at MillerKnoll in this function.
Sure. Well, first I'll start by saying MillerKnoll is a name that maybe people haven't heard because it's a fairly newly created entity. When we at Herman Miller and our family of companies joined up with Knoll and their family of companies. So it's a collection of design brands that includes some very well-known furniture companies like Herman Miller, Knoll, Hay, Muto, Not One, and others, but also a variety of textile companies. And we're focused on helping to create great places for people, including workplace, but also well beyond. Previously, I led the global research team at Herman Miller. So when we formed this new collection, we moved our team into MillerKnoll at that kind of parent brand level and began working across our brands, doing research globally, looking at changes in work, workplace, but also living, homes, schools, a variety of other spaces, in addition to trying to use those insights to make sure that we serve our customers well. We also share a lot of those insights directly with customers in the market. We have a group of full-time insight sharers on my team whose only job is to make sure that what we learn gets out into the market so that we can help people.
Why do you think is a global research function important to a company like MillerKnoll?
The easiest way for me to say it is so that we don't end up looking like the toothpaste aisle at the grocery store. When you don't do good primary research, you end up just making copies of other people's solutions with small, meaningless points of difference. But between Knoll and Herman Miller as our two flagships, research and exploration into the future began at both organizations a long time ago. You know, back in the 1940s, Florence Knoll was exploring how to design spaces differently, created something called Knoll Planning Unit, which basically became the archetype for interior design firms. Herman Miller started a formal research effort, although they'd been doing research informally before that, in the 1960s, looking at future of work. In fact, when Stanford University showed the world the first personal computer in 1968, Herman Miller designed the environment for it, even though personal computers wouldn't become common for another 15 to 20 years. So this notion of exploring the future, understanding changes in people's expectations and their patterns of behavior to inform our view of what the spaces need to do is then the key to helping us figure out what products to offer. If we just stared at, you know, the legs of tables all day long and said, we need to make a better desk leg, I shudder to think of what our portfolio of products would be. We need to understand people, their processes and the places, and then we can figure out what to make.
Funny that future of work, it was a topic in 1968 or in the 60s or 40s already. So actually, we should call it presence of work when we talk about today, right? Because it's not really future. It's what people have thought about in the 70s and 80s when the computers weren't that common yet.
Well, that's the blessing and curse of trying to look at future work patterns is that you do see things coming, but there's this maddeningly frustrating sense that we've known this for so long. So if you look as an example of a movement out of Germany after World War II called Bürolandschaft or office landscape, it suggested that the office should be like a cityscape. It should have a bunch of variety and choice. People should move through it and be able to go from times of personal concentration and focus to times of being social. Desktop computing and the 30 years where we had to sit in front of a desktop monitor screwed all that up. But in some ways, we're still, you know, just now beginning to move towards visions of what work was supposed to be like 60 or 70 years ago, which I guess is encouraging on one hand and rather kind of a downer on the other. But these patterns tend to change slowly. Yeah.
Yeah, we don't like change in corporate real estate because real estate, by definition, is unmovable. So that's how we tend to think. Now, joke aside, who are your stakeholders then? Who do you collaborate with? We've heard you put that out for your clients, the research, but I would imagine you have a lot of touch points with internal MillerKnoll departments as well, informing them about what is coming.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't get asked that very often. We live within strategy, so I report to our chief strategy officer. And so our internal stakeholders include the many brands within the MillerKnoll family, and specifically the product teams, the marketing teams, the strategy teams, and the executive leadership teams, amongst others. But we tend to think even more broadly than that. As an example, we have a once a month internal only webinar where we ask someone from the market to just share what's going on, literally open it up to any employee, manufacturing associates, distribution, finance, accounting, anyone, because we think that the more that we all know about what's happening in the world and the people we serve, the better. So internally, it's broad, but mostly it's those making strategy, marketing, and product decisions. Externally, if I think specifically about workplace, we are focused on, yes, the occupier. So that would include head of corporate real estate, workplace strategy, facilities management, but also increasingly HR, IT, and other functions. That's not new, but we've dialed that up. Then colleagues in the commercial real estate services world that are providing either advisory services, PM, FM, brokerage, architecture and design firms, and our own dealer partners, right? We sell through these amazing channel partners around the world. Everyone benefits from having a little bit clearer sense of either where things are going or the challenges that customers globally are having right now. And so, you know, our team is spread from Dallas to Dubai, and we have a lot of external collaborators on the research side as well. So we're always trying to distill what's most useful. In fact, we named the team the Global Research and Insights Team because research is the process of going and digging, but those insights are the gold. So it's up to us to not bore people with the process of the research, but just to get them what they need. It's a broad set of stakeholders internally and externally, but that's what gets us up every day.
Sounds like it. Where do you think you have a different perception than someone that is within a CRE organization?
Well, I think that's changing a little bit, but historically, we've been probably more focused on people and their patterns of behavior and how those patterns change over time. A well-designed building should have a degree of permanence, and it should be able to be flexible enough, agile enough, and sustainable enough over time to accommodate many different groups, many different types of activities. But it would be a mistake to assume that it just happens automatically. Like, we have to be able to understand people and their expectations and what they're actually trying to do to make sure that we bridge the clock speed between those changes in people and their work and the life of the building. So that's where we're focused. And in particular, we sometimes talk about work settings or work applications. What we mean by that is the use of furniture and how it's applied is really the bridge. It's a little bit like Legos. If you look at the front of a box of Legos, nobody's buying it because they're seeing a picture of a brick. They're buying it because they see a picture of a castle or a truck. And so we make furniture, but it's all about how it's applied. And if it's applied well, it can create really wonderful environments in which to engage and get work done. If it's applied poorly, it can be a disaster. And so for us, it's about making sure the building is evolving, that people love it there by applying the furniture and other environmental kind of products in the right way.
And they can, like with the Lego bricks, also make it their own and not build it the way it was on the cover picture, but find their own creative use of it and make it their personal experience.
Well, and I think that's one of the biggest trends happening right now. I mean, we've been trying to enable this for a long time, but it's really taking off, which is allowing people who work in the environment to have more ability to adapt the environment to their needs. Historically, that really wasn't the case. But if you look at the process of designing an environment, the interior design process usually starts with an assessment of the work being done, what is known within interior design as program development. But these days, when you ask someone, so how do you work? They're probably going to tell you, well, I've been in my bedroom for the last 2 years. So as a result, it's pretty difficult to suggest that any interior design is right. I think the better option is to create a space that evolves over time. And if you can let the employees move things around, adapt them, give them more agility, it's just a better return on those investments because you're assured that people aren't working around the environment, but the environment's actually supporting them.
And design is such a subjective thing. What I like, you might hate in terms of color and things in the room and so on. So you'll never build something to the taste of everyone. So you probably will not get it right. But I'd still be curious, what does your office look like, actually? And what do you personally appreciate about the office as a place where you can conduct work? Do you have a favorite corner maybe in the office?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really, really fortunate because I get to work out of the best environments in the world. And that includes our offices, but it also includes our work from home. So as an organization, MillerKnoll supports hybrid working. I've been working in a hybrid way since 2014. I have an amazing work from home setup with a Herman Miller chair, or it might be a Knoll head adjustable desk or whatever our employees feel like they would most benefit from. But our offices are wonderful places to be. They're different than what you would find in most places. I can give you a few ways in which they're different, but I think we've always conceptualized them as on-demand resources, like places that people don't have to go, but they need to be designed as places that really offer value so that people want to go. Our spaces emphasize a few different things. One, it's an excellent place for socialization and community building, just as a chance to see people that you don't work with on a regular basis, because people can be very effective digitally, but you tend to get into patterns where you only are scheduling meetings or chatting with the people in your immediate work team. So the environments are wonderful at building social connection. They're also, interestingly, really good at providing areas of focused concentration. So you can move from an area that feels very social, like a cafe, into an area that feels very quiet, like a study hall. Because we know that if I look at the data from Herman Miller's work from home tool, of the 25,000 people that have used it globally, I think 58% say they struggle with focused concentration at home. Like as an example, I think I mentioned to you earlier, I've got a little bit of construction work going on in the bathroom, but it might be a dog. It might be spotty Wi-Fi. It might be a partner who's got a Zoom call going on. So some days, yeah, people might be able to concentrate. Others, they need to know that if they're going to spend 2 or 3 hours in a really important spreadsheet or presentation that they've got a place to do it. But most of our spaces, they consist of team neighborhoods. So if you look at the overall floor plans, yes, there will be very social areas and there will be very quiet areas, and those are shared by everyone. But most of the floor plan are dedicated to individual teams. And I'm getting a little into interior design language here now, but in some parts of the world, we might find activity-based working environments where everything is shared. Like you go to a building and all the desks, all the meeting rooms, all the social areas are shared. In the U.S., traditionally, it was more traditional occupancy planning. So you'd find the desks were all assigned and the conference rooms are shared. Neighborhood-based planning is a happy medium that I really love. I've seen it mostly in Australia and a few other places. But basically what it means is each team has a collection of space, individual spaces, individual desks, meeting rooms, sofas, maybe a little project space. And those are shared among all the team members. So even if your team has 40 people, maybe only 18 are in on a given day, it gives people this sense of predictability as to where their group is. It gives teams that might spend regular time on video the chance to have a less formal, less structured time of interaction. Like if you want to spend a couple hours hanging out, you don't do it on video. And it provides like this nice scalable balance so that if the team grows or shrinks, you don't have to redo the space. So the I guess the benefits from a flexibility standpoint of activity-based planning, but more the predictability that people might have had when they knew where their teammates might be found, if that makes sense. I had this friend who's a workplace strategist in Australia say to me once, hybrid working is a lot like going to a party. You might go to see people that you don't know, but there's no way you're going to go without a friend. And so that's what neighborhoods do, is they give you the chance to go be social, but when you're ready just to hang out with like your people, you kind of know where they are. And not everybody will be there in a given day, but that's okay. You'll enjoy the benefit of connecting with whomever might be.
I've noticed even if there's no neighborhoods like really assigned, it tends to happen anyway. So we have like no assignments, but I know where our department's hanging out. Usually it's that corner and the colleagues from the development department are in the other space of the office. So you know where people tend to go and where you would find them. So I know I usually go to that corner over there and try to find a spot in there. It's just, I think it's just human behavior, right? We want to be with our tribe and in our cave.
That's exactly right. And the researcher in me is smiling big because you're describing these evolved patterns of behavior. So if the entire environment's shared, it's activity-based working, but you know that each group has kind of carved out a little clubhouse.
Yeah.
Neighborhood-based planning is like the next evolution of it. By the way, we posted a video of the building that I'm working out of on Herman Miller's Future of Work Hub, which is hermanmiller.com/future of work. And the name of the building is called Design Yard. It's worth checking out. It's not for everybody. We always say that the building should reflect the culture of the organization. As an example, you will see some very, very bold colors being used in our social areas because we want to express optimism and enthusiasm about being together. And then you'll find it to be much more chill in other areas. We know that some organizations that come through here, and we do, we have customers coming through to visit every day, might say, oh, that doesn't feel right for us. The goal is, let's figure out what's right for you. But for us, it's a pretty good expression of how we believe we'll be working for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. And I mean, if you weren't like showcasing the extremes, we wouldn't get to see it that much because corporations tend not to go there. I think other than the very progressive ones, like the Googles and others who have like all the equipment and money as well to spend on workplace design, which actually brings me to a point when I still used to work on the occupier side in corporate real estate. My main pressure was budget, right? Cost of occupation. Have you seen that changing from before the pandemic so that customers now come in and it's like, oh, cost's not that much of a issue anymore. We really want to personalize and look at the employees and consumers of our space?
That's a fantastic question. It's evolving right now. So there's a few things that come to my mind. One is, I think the capital planning processes have always been a challenge because let's just say an organization set aside a large amount of money at lease expiration to go do a big project or big redo. But they knew that the people who were working in the space and the work they were doing 2 years after they started, you know, after they opened the doors were different. And so it's too long. In some ways, I would love to see it if those big capital budgets that happened every 7 or 10 years just were smaller amounts, more incrementally, so that you could make the space better over time. But I also think there's like this bifurcation happening right now in corporate office where we're seeing a push to premium among many organizations that have said, we want desirable offices. They're going to be a part of our plan. So let's go get good Class A space, trophy assets. Let's sign for those. And then the Class B and C stuff that's maybe not as desirable, people sometimes are more apt to walk away from it. Now, we believe that the interior can take a space that might not be quite as nice of building and turn it into a wonderful environment. So we spend more and more time talking about that. But yeah, I think there's a difference. There's those organizations that maybe feel like the value of corporate office space is more important than ever, and others that feel like it's less so. And it's all a factor of how they work it into this new approach to supporting work. Office first, hybrid, remote first. But even then, organizations that are remote first or going major into hybrid, many still look at their office space and say, no, it needs to be really good. So it's kind of a muddy answer I just gave you, but I think it's because it's evolving. What we're seeing, and it doesn't necessarily apply to a particular industry or geography, is those organizations that have said, I get the value of the space we offer and we need to make it good. Even if there's less of it, we want it to be high quality. And others that are still just kind of trying to figure it out. And maybe they signed a few lease extensions in 2020. They're now thinking about maybe giving up. There's a lot of customers on that journey too. They're just still trying to figure out what the real value of that space is.
Yeah, just had two thoughts. The one was with the interior. I think you're so right, because the building we're in as well, it's not pretty. It's like from the 80s, the facade's like this typical beige, brown, really, really ugly. But when you're inside, you look on the pretty new build that's across the street. So I'm rather in this building with a nice interior looking on a nice building than in the other one looking at that dump.
So, you know, you're absolutely right. And actually, in recent years, we've had more and more landlords come to us and say, hey, you know, can you just help us think about the interior of the space, elevating the quality of the space through the interior? It absolutely can be done. So even with spec suites and other types of space that might not have always screamed like this is really nice, it's about the attention paid to the design of the interior and how it supports people. And contrary to many people's thoughts, it doesn't have to be wildly expensive. It can just be well considered. And I often say that in this world of on-demand offices, the most important attribute they need is to be desirable. Like, they have to be places that people find valuable and want to come. And so I think organizations need to take a fresh look. Even if the building might not be top-notch, the interior can be wonderful.
And the other thing I picked up on was when you actually earlier, when you said you have a wonderful home setting as well with appropriate ergonomic furniture at home. I think that's something that's not happening in the industry yet at large, that companies are acknowledging the home office as a setting they can positively influence as well. But they're like so focused on getting class A office super well designed to draw people in. And then people might still at the day decide not to go in, not because the office isn't looking good, because it's more convenient to be at home with whatever they have planned in the day. So I think there's a shift still going to happen, hopefully.
There is. We're a founding partner in an initiative called Future Forum, which is a research collaboration with Slack, Boston Consulting Group, and Management Leadership for Tomorrow and MillerKnoll. And we survey 10,000 knowledge workers globally every quarter. We do executive roundtables. And I think what you just described is absolutely right. There's a lot of organizations, upwards of 60%, that are intending to support hybrid working. And in fact, more than 50% of the people surveyed say they're already splitting their time between locations. And if you talk to the IT departments at organizations, they made the mental shift from we support work in the office to we support the employees wherever they're working years ago. Now it's time for corporate real estate and facilities team to make the same mental shift. And I know the term corporate real estate probably in and of itself defines this rather narrowly. But the reality is, if someone is going to spend 20 or 40% of their time working from home, the office actually may be freed to be better. Instead of a sea of desks that are all, you know, assigned space, you can actually add more choice and variety. But then that 20 or 40% also represents potential lost productivity or a chance for injury, et cetera, outside of a healthy working environment. And so the most progressive customers we've got have said, all right, in this new balance, we're going to support people at home. It might be that they get them a Wi-Fi router or a webcam or an ergonomic chair. By the way, all the data that I've seen, not just from us, but from organizations like Leesman, et cetera, point to the chair specifically as the biggest need for most people working from home, because too many people are still working from four-legged wooden chairs, and it's just not good for their backs, shoulders, eyes, et cetera. But then also, if someone has a place to do productive individual work from home, it does free the office then to not have to be a sea of desks, but instead to have more variety, choice, offerings, to get back to that notion of a cityscape or a landscape, so that people, sure, they enjoy working at home, but they find something different and valuable from the office. Sometimes I'll use the analogy of a restaurant, not in terms of the design of a restaurant, but you know, we can easily cook from home, but we do enjoy the process of dining out because a well-designed restaurant provides us social connection, convenience. It's an enjoyable experience. If done right, again, not the design necessarily mimicking a restaurant, but the intent, then the office should provide us a wonderful complement from being able to not just work by ourselves at home all the time. Just organizations haven't really viewed that landscape of place where people could work as synonymous with workplace. They've been too focused on office as synonymous with workplace.
Yeah. As you said, because it's in their role description, and that's what we're trying to do. But we see the role descriptions changing as well. There's loads of head of remote, head of hybrid, workplace experience managers, community managers coming mm-hmm. into the space. So that makes me really hopeful that that we'll get there. Do you see ripple effects from how corporate real estate is evolving a bit slowly but surely to the real estate industry at large? I mean, your furniture design company probably has effects on you and also on the landlords and whoever servicing the industry.
Oh, I think there's so many. It was really a wake-up call, 2020 and 2021, that corporate offices don't have a monopoly on where work's being done. By the way, distributed working, the spreading out of work, had been going on for 15 years before the pandemic, right? When we got Wi-Fi, people started working in new places on the floor plan. They started working outside of the office and beyond. If we look at space utilization trends, desk utilization, as an example, went down by and large year over year for many years leading into the pandemic because people were spending less time at individual desks. And so if let's just say an organization had 30 or 40% occupancy rate, they probably should have been asking the question, is this a good return on our corporate real estate investments? But because the mentality was, if you're an office worker, you work from the office, there was this view that it was a monopolistic kind of thing. The pandemic woke everyone up and said, no, actually, not just now, but for years, the offices had competition with a variety of other places where people can work. And it either needs to find its sweet spot, or it might be redundant or unnecessary. And so in the corporate real estate world, I think there's a lot of questions about what is the real purpose of an office. I think there's been a really major influx of HR, human resources voices, into this conversation because as organizations started their RTO plans, HR got involved, started asking questions around what's the role of workplace experience as a subset of employee experience. This is all good, actually, for the most part, I think. If we look at landlords or we look at the services firms like CBRE, JLL, Cushman, et cetera, I think they're beginning to look at the role of workplace strategy and facilities management in more strategic ways, maybe than, well, I shouldn't say that they are. Maybe they always viewed it in that way, but more attention being paid to it. I think organizations on the brokerage side are beginning to ask the question, what does occupancy planning look like? What's the right amount of space? So across the board, there's a reevaluation going on of what's the value of corporate real estate, how much and what type should it be? And I don't know that that's all bad because personally, when I would see a space in, say, 2019, that was a sea of desks, small desks, mostly sitting empty, and generic conference rooms that weren't really great for anything other than an hour meeting, we knew that offices could be so much more, but there just wasn't enough catalyst to get people to move off from that old planning methodology. So I'm hoping that organizations land on understanding why offices are, in fact, still very valuable in an era of digital remote working and begin to conceptualize their spaces better than maybe they had in the past.
Yeah, and highlight those functions that the office is actually a good place for, an appreciated place to go.
Yeah, I'll just add one reference that increasingly I've been using is people need to like experience a different sort of office to even know, like, what do you really mean? And that's why when we can, we get people into MillerKnoll facilities or our dealer facilities. But one reference that I do think is somewhat helpful is the better airport lounges. So if you go into like a really nice airline and their signature airport lounges, what you tend to find when you go in is it feels like a special experience. There's a social area Maybe it's serving drinks at a bar, and maybe in the case of an office, it might be more likely coffee, et cetera. But there's also places to go and do heads down work. And there's in some cases even places for respite and wellness. And what you don't find is just, it's not like just a sea of desks in the middle of a space. It's both social and private. And I guess a little feeling of exclusivity, like this is a special place to be. Now, the bad ones don't necessarily fit that bill. But if there's one maybe mental reference that could help most, if you've had the privilege of being in a space like that, a lot of the better offices around the world have some similar characteristics. It's not a perfect one-to-one analogy, but it might be a helpful reference.
You've painted a picture now of certain scenarios that could happen with the office in the future. Do you see different trends between industries, actually, which kind of models they favor? Is it kind of a mixed bag still?
There are definitely industry trends, but the one that just stands out the most is technology. I'll give you kind of unfiltered editorial perspective from me. The tech world's always been fascinating because it's the industry which best enables working anywhere. Yet their commitment to having a lot of real estate's always been really interesting. In some cases, it's been wonderful because the leading organizations that understand remote also understand the limits of remote, and they want to complement what they can do technologically with really wonderful space. On the flip side are a whole group of companies, I won't get specific, whose commitment to real estate has been because they expect people to be there day and night. You know, laundry facilities on the same floors as offices because they expected people to come in at 9 a.m. and leave at 9 p.m. And I never really viewed them as good proxies for the future of work because that's more of a cultural thing. That's about presenteeism. That's around, you know, trying to get, I guess, the most amount of work out of the least amount of time for employees. And so right now, if we look at the tech world, you may have seen of the big leases signed in 2021, a shockingly disproportionate number of them were from tech companies, by far the number one industry. If I think to some of the reports I've seen from CBRE, JLL, and others, it was like tech number one, public sector in the US as number two, life sciences and a few others, but tech was just really, really heavy. And so I think it remains to be seen if this is because the tech world has determined that in an era of hybrid, they need to have amazing office spaces to complement great homework spaces, or if it continues to be propagated by an older view that everybody needs to be in the office all the time.
That means to some extent, space planning there hasn't really changed in a way. They haven't reduced spaces. And I've seen a couple of reports as well where I think Harvard Business Review did put one out where they said for the near future, they don't expect huge decrease in space take up. Actually, contrary, only like 1% of space is handed back. But I think that might be a US thing. I've had a conversation with someone working for the Dutch civil service and they've gone fully hybrid. I was really surprised because civil service in my mind is always like, ooh, super tight to the office. I've lost my thread.
Well, that's okay. I think I know where you're going with this because it is a natural assumption that if employees are spending 20 or 30% of their time working from home or elsewhere, that corporate office portfolios will decrease by 20 or 30%. But when you dig into that assumption, it often is not true. So you referenced an HBR piece that I'm familiar with, indicating that in the US, we only saw a 1% reduction in corporate real estate portfolios in the US in 2021. Now, it might grow. Nobody wants to divest themselves of space in a down market. And a lot of people were just signing lease extensions in 20 and 2021 that are now going to be coming up soon. But here's the things to consider. First, the massive move towards densification, putting as many small desks in the space as possible, had already shrunk up portfolios a lot. And so the first step that most organizations go through when they go to hybrid is to de-densify. If you move beyond the idea that everybody needs X amount of meters dedicated to them and we're going to give it to them in the form of a small desk, you say, well, no, we're open to neighborhood-based planning or desk sharing, et cetera. You can pull some of that product out of there, start putting more individual focused rooms, well-being rooms, project spaces. You can begin to vary what's in that space in a way that makes, I think, very good use of the space. I think we'll do that in the midst of a lease rather than necessarily at a lease event. Both will happen. But I think because there's such demand right now to adapt offices, many people are doing it to their existing spaces. The flip side of this is that when you do that, you're creating a more desirable environment. And so now the question becomes, well, how much space do I need if people actually find value in getting together socially, having longer duration team meetings, finding spaces for individual focus? And so if I look even at remote first companies who in theory shouldn't need any corporate office space, most have it. Most have some sort of space in more of a hub and spoke approach where people can still come in and spend time. So the early assumptions around hybrid working and the decrease in corporate portfolios, I think, need a lot more attention. And I don't think that most of them are true. I'm not even convinced that most organizations will see a significant decrease in their corporate portfolios if they, in fact, shift to making spaces that are more interesting, more desirable, and that employees find to be more valuable.
You managed to go exactly where I wanted to go, because I had noted as well to ask you about the new workplace types that are incorporated into offices. And that's, exactly where you landed on with this one.
Yeah. We refer to them as work settings. So these are like little mini environments. We need to see a more diverse range of work settings in the space. So if today the average office has a lot of open desks and a lot of basic conference rooms, you can start with just thinking about adding in some social spaces that feel like good places to connect with community. That could be in the intersection of the facility, either inside the building or right in the front. We need to see more spaces for focus and concentration, including more spaces to take individual video calls. These could be phone booths, but it doesn't have to be. There's a variety of types of more private environments. And then more of the team areas that we talked about before. But the goal is to provide people choice. But choices that are intuitive, so that when someone looks at it, they go, oh, okay, I get it. I know I can work from home, but in this case, I might be able to have a really good hangout session with three or four colleagues that I haven't seen in a while, and then move over there and do some really heads down work. The next frontier of this, by the way, Sabine, is not just to offer variety, but make sure that variety helps to create the most equitable and inclusive work experiences possible. And I'm just going to unpack this for a second. Offering more flexibility and choice in and of itself increases equitable work experiences, because you find that people have a much greater range of need on a day-to-day basis than what you might realize. So it could be that someone, well, like me, would work from home on a day where they face distractions, would work in the office on a day where they face distractions at home. But you might find that somebody would choose their place of work based on the work they're doing on a given day, or maybe they've got a physical, sensory, or cognitive need that needs to be taken care of. Maybe, as I mentioned before, somebody's Wi-Fi is really spotty and they're just going to be more productive one place or the other. But there's also other things. People of color that are experiencing code switching in the office might find a degree of respite at home or in a quieter part of the office. We recently featured on our webinar series conversations around the impact of menopause on women in menopausal age in the workforce. The government in the UK has been looking into this and just how many women leave the workforce during those years, because menopause is a multi-year thing that can have a variety of challenging effects on getting work done. Well, believe it or not, there are things you can do in the office to ease some of this. And so if you offer good variety, you should be looking at the full range of human conditions and saying, how can the choices we offer really provide the best solutions for everyone that might need it, which ultimately creates a greater sense of belonging among everyone. So it's a deeper topic, and I could go much, much farther into what specific types of spaces might be of service to any number of people. That's the lens that we should start with, is how do these spaces get more valuable by offering greater variety? And then if we do it right, how can the spaces that we offer solve as many people's needs as possible to create more inclusive and equitable experiences?
I completely agree. And I'm going to open the box of the Pandora now.
Good.
How do we measure that? How do we measure the value the office is providing to all those diverse groups?
So I'll start with a kind of simple framework, and it needs to get probably more mature than what I'm going to share with you. But I see it as a two-sided coin. The first one being good utilization or occupancy data, because it's a little bit like going to the physician and getting your heartbeat, your pulse checked. I think having good utilization data gives you a sense of what's kind of the pulse, what's happening here. And a lot of organizations might still only be using badge swipes in, so they might know how many people come to a facility, but being able to get more granular, this is how the space was used. This is how the group spaces were used relative to the individual spaces. These are how the neighborhoods are used relative to the study hall is helpful because it begins to give you a sense of use and its correlated activities that are there. Like, what is this space designed to support people doing? And let's see how it's used. But having said that, it's also possible to take that too far. Not every space should be measured in terms of its success solely by use, because there are some spaces that might not be used a lot, but that are extremely valuable. So if I think about like the island in the kitchen of my home, I don't go around saying, we used it 6 times this week, but last year we were using it 3 times a week. I just look at it and go, that's where we hang out and that's where the kids do their homework. So sentiment is the other side of the coin. Some measure of how valuable is this space to you? I'll give you an example. We might have like a Knoll womb chair sitting in the corner of a facility where someone might be able to read or take a quiet moment. And it might only get used 15% of the time. But if you took it away, people would be ticked off because that's an amenity they really love. Likewise, you might have a conference room that's used 60% of the time, which, by the way, is actually high for conference room usage. People might hate it. It just happens to be the room that's most proximate to where they do some of their other work. So I think if you start with how is the space used and how do our employees feel about it, together you get a really nice baseline. And those data points will maybe not answer all your questions, but it'll certainly help you ask better ones.
Get you thinking about things. I'm going to make an example as well. We've done a small benchmarking study as a pilot. We've had the feedback from, it was interesting. So in the occupancy data, looking at collaboration versus desk spaces, utilization was highest in the desk spaces actually, and not the conference rooms. And when we asked employees what type of work they mostly perform in the office, to 60%, they said collaboration, which really didn't reflect in the utilization data. So then the question is kind of, okay, is this organization not providing the right collaboration spaces for that collaborative work? That's why it happens on the desks kind of in between. Or do the employees have a wrong perception of how or what kind of work they're actually conducting? And it could be either or, I really don't know. But that's the beauty of things, you start to think about it.
Yeah, exactly. It's letting you ask better questions. I'll add a third, which is, are we defining collaboration differently? So collaboration has largely moved from being synchronous and co-located, like people in a room at the same time, to being asynchronous and distributed. So if we were to get on a Google Doc and you and I were to create like an outline for this episode, we probably wouldn't do it at the same time. So individually, we'd be collaborating with each other. But if you looked at it, it would look like somebody with their laptop. This is the way that music is produced, as an example. People don't go into a studio with a bottle of whiskey and record tracks for 2 days on end. One person's in London, another person's in Tokyo, and it's all done asynchronously. And so we kind of have to step back sometimes even and just say, are we agreeing on what this means? But again, if you don't have the data and you don't begin to ask the questions, you can't ever get to that deeper layer of understanding about what people are doing. You know, one thing that I think we all need to consider in this world of video is that the UIs, the user experiences for most of the video platforms that we use, Zoom, Teams, et cetera, are designed for individual use. So we've seen a surprising amount of people sitting at desks but taking individual video calls. So if you ask them, what are you doing in the office? They'll say meetings, but they're taking it individually. And by the way, most desks aren't very well designed to support video calls. So yeah, these are the new patterns that we talked about before that we all have to understand. And while it's complicated, if we begin to measure use and we measure sentiment, and then we maybe do some focus groups, take it a step farther and say, well, tell us, like, what are you really doing? This is the key to making sure that we get good return on those occupancy investments in the future, right?
So true. Now I get to ask a question that I really like, and it's one of the closing questions. And here it comes. It is, if you could magically solve any real estate or workplace problem, what would it be?
Probably the one that I would start with was I would hit the reset button on all the assumptions among leaders about what the office is for. Even to the point where if I really had that magic wand, which I'm glad to take if you've got one, I would give the employees of every organization the chance to do whatever they wanted in the office for a month. Meaning, forget about all of our expectations that you're in a desk a certain amount of time or that you're here for meetings. Just consider the space a resource to you and your teams. What do you want to do here? Do you want to come and have a party here? Do you want to come and celebrate somebody's birthday? Do you want to come and do a week-long deep dive into the future? Those patterns need to be released a little bit, because even after all that we've been through, every single day, I talk with customers and other organizations where the leaders have this assumption about what an employee is supposed to do in the office. Can we just completely release that for a second and say the office is an asset that is seeking to be valuable, and facilities and real estate people are a little bit like marketers with the end users as their customers. And if we were a marketing team, we'd be saying, what are our customers' needs? What are their demand patterns? How do we measure demand? And ultimately, is the product that we offer what they want? And I don't see a lot of organizations truly going there. I see them loosening up on their historic kind of binary view of office worker versus remote worker. But like, just get super real with this and say, if we were to build a real estate portfolio around what our employees wanted from the office, what would it be? And we can't say collaboration, because that's too generic. What is it really? What would cause you to make the commute? How often would you like to be there? If we did more of this or less of this, what would our real estate portfolio end up looking like? Would it be more like an airport lounge or a restaurant or a study hall or a higher education campus or a home? We need to just give ourselves the freedom to loosen up on all of our assumptions, because 90% of the assumptions of what an office should be came around in an era of desktop computers, where people had to be in a certain spot to do their work. Supervisors could see it. Group work was only done in conference rooms. And that's been gone for a long time.
I'm 100% backing this magical wish. So we're two behind it. Probably, hopefully, it's going to come true. So now, my last question is a little bit selfish, and it's the way actually I got to meet you. So who else should we have on the podcast? And is there something you would like to ask them?
This is a wonderful question. The trouble is, like, 30 names just popped into my head.
Yeah. You could send me an email.
And I will. Adrienne Rowe, head of workplace at Raytheon. Adrienne's freaking brilliant. I hosted her on Herman Miller's podcast, which you can also find on that Herman Miller Future of Work Hub. She's so interesting, and she has a research background that I think her take on real estate and its future is really useful. I frequently check in with other experts that I think are doing interesting things. Dr. Andrea Shagu at MIT heads the Real Estate Innovation Lab at MIT. Somebody that I've been following for a long time is Dr. Joseph Allen at Chan School of Public Health at Harvard, talking about healthy buildings and what it really means to have buildings that promote health rather than take a toll on health. So there's a bunch, but most of them are pushing the boundaries on what these spaces ultimately want to be for us and how we can reimagine them.
Nothing to add. Thank you so much for taking the time and coming on. It's been really insightful.
Thank you for having me. It's a privilege and it's been fun.
Thanks for listening. If you have enjoyed this episode of The Workplace Leader, there's more. Go visit our blog and have a look at some of the other topics we have covered. We've just released the definitive guide to workplace analytics, for instance. Or tune into our next episode of The Workplace Leader.